Live from the Ken and Valerie Baker studio at WHYY, this is Studio 2.
On Wednesday, the 9th of September, welcome, friends, on Into the Program. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Kevin McCrory, in for Avi Wolfman-Arrant.
So, Kevin, a little more than a week ago, it was the morning of September 1st, you and I were sitting right here when just 20 minutes before we went live for this show, we got a breaking news alert. The Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University would close its museum at the end of the month. 30 days. And almost immediately, you could feel the reaction across the city. People who went there as kids, people who take their kids there now, scientists who built careers there, people who worked there, people who may not have been in years, but could not imagine Philadelphia without the Academy. There was sadness, there was anger, and lots of questions. Drexel says declining attendance and rising operating costs have made the museum unsustainable. And while the public-facing museum is going to close, Drexel says the Academy itself will continue. But what does that actually mean? And what will be the impact on the broader community? So today we're going to pull back the curtain. We have the reporter who broke the story on the show. We have the deputy mayor who's handling the transition, the closure, who will be on the show. And then we'll also hear from two scientists. And we're going to talk about how we got here, what will be saved, what will be lost, and whether anything about this decision could change. And of course, we'd love to hear what the Academy has meant to you and to the community. And so our questions of the day, what place has the Academy had in your life? What memories will you carry with you? And also, what would you hope happens now? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube or Facebook, you can put your comments in the live chat. And Kevin, I know you grew up in Philadelphia. Yeah. Your kids love the Academy. So what does it mean to you?
Yeah, I think it's just that space of nostalgia. You know, you think back to when you're a kid and you get on the school bus for the school trip and you go in there and you see a different world. Maybe it was your first time seeing a big dinosaur or seeing the sort of dioramas and all that stuff. And it's one of those things that it just feels like it has always been there. It will always be there. So I think that there's that shock to the system. And we've seen such response to the news of the closure.
Rallies.
It's clearly touching a nerve. People are out there now trying to save it and see if there's some viable path forward. We'll see if those efforts can push something else into a direction. And you're going to have that conversation today. So I'm really curious to see like what the deputy mayor would say to the question of, is there a viable path to get this to continue to be a museum in this building the way that people have known it, enjoyed it for years? Or is that really just a non-starter at this point?
Yeah, people were rallying outside of the Academy yesterday. I didn't grow up here, but I've been to the Academy and I was really shocked at how much people love this place.
Right.
And so we're going to have those conversations again. We'd love to hear from you. 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And we're going to try to get in as many callers as we can. And we have our trio of local news stories, Kevin.
Yeah, first story, Cherry. Immigration advocates claim that the largest workplace raid in Pennsylvania happened over 2 days last week in central Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. So advocates say 49 people who were working on a construction site for the Geisinger Medical Center in Danville were taken into custody by ICE agents who were collaborating with local police. Shout out to Jeff Gamage at the Philadelphia Inquirer for this reporting. Yeah. Officials for ICE and the Department of Homeland Security could not be reached for confirmation or comment, but the advocates say the men arrested were from countries including Nicaragua, El Salvador, Honduras. Geisinger said it was aware of the action, but says the arrest did not happen on its property, and it said its construction project was being overseen by a third-party project manager who it expects to be in compliance with work eligibility rules. So they're claiming a bit of separation from this. Advocates say that ICE used drones to monitor the work site and that the arrests happened as workers left or arrived for their shifts. And in some cases, law enforcement followed people back to their homes. We know, Cherry, that large sectors of our economy, construction, agriculture, dining, hospitality, run largely because of immigrant labor in many cases. And this has been one of the big questions. How much would the Trump administration push on those industries as it tries to reach its very large deportation goals.
Yeah, I mean, this is a situation where the people arrested are likely outside of the scope of the president's original campaign promises when it comes to immigration enforcement. Remember, he said that ICE would be focused on violent criminals. These people were working on a construction site. We are in a housing crisis. This was not housing, but still, we need things to be built, and we need people to do the labor. And the second part, and I think you pointed this out, these ICE raids are likely coming into direct conflict with business interests in several industries. We have so many people within the immigrant community who work in construction, hospitality, agriculture. Right. And I suspect there will be a ripple effect to their willingness to come to work, whether they are documented or not. It raises a lot of anxiety, right? Because people are getting swept up, regardless if you have your paperwork right. or not. Some people are getting swept up. You may get detained. You could be let go if your paperwork is sufficient. But this has a ripple effect as far as like impact on families. And it's very scary to a lot of people.
Yeah. And like, you know, you said the administration said it would go after, you know, the worst offenders, et cetera. But they also set these very, very high deportation targets.
That? Yeah.
So we all knew that it was beyond just the violent criminals, right, in society. It had to go somewhere else. And so then this question is, are they really going to really push on, again, these pillars of the economy where if you take a chunk of the workforce out, it could be detrimental in all sorts of ways.
Yeah.
So we'll see. We'll watch this as it develops. This was a big story, like we said, in central mm-hmm. Pennsylvania last week. That's just coming out now, and we'll continue to watch it as we move forward.
Yeah.
Story number two, Cherry.
Yeah. Temple University recently canceled the largest single donation in the institution's history after the federal government began investigating the donor's company for money laundering and other federal crimes. It was a $55 million donation. It was going to be a gift from Christopher Barnett, who is a Temple alum and owns ABA Centers of America. That company provides behavioral health services to people with autism. And so the money was intended to go to Temple's College of Public Health. The college would have been named after Barnett, right? The ABA Centers of America, though, is now under federal criminal investigation for healthcare fraud. According to the indictment that was just unsealed, there is alleged evidence that the company billed insurance companies for unnecessary treatments and then falsified documents to support higher reimbursement rates. And according to the Philadelphia Inquirer, the decision to terminate this multi-million dollar gift was mutual, as between President John Fry and Chris Barnett. By the way, Fry has said the Temple had to think about its values and the school's representation. And given that the donation was for the public health college and the allegations were for fraud in that industry, as painful as it was, the two organizations were no longer in alignment. And I should mention that Chris Barnett is recovering from a life-threatening medical event. He is not personally charged with a crime, but the indictment alleges that monies from overbilling have been used to fund a lavish lifestyle, including a fleet of rare cars and a private jet. And I should also mention the timeline here. Fry learned of the allegations on Thursday after that indictment was unsealed, and then reached out to Barnett. He resigned from the Temple Board of Trustees over the weekend, and none of the payments scheduled from this $55 million donation have been made as of yet.
Yeah, really tough for Temple, tough pill to swallow. Higher ed has been facing uphill yeah. battle on many different fronts, and here comes a big philanthropic check, and you think, okay, well, this is really good news, and then unfortunately it went this way. Story number three,
yeah.
Cherry, did you hear that Philadelphia went and stole Burlington from New Jersey?
What?
The retail chain, formerly known as Burlington Coat Factory, started mm-hmm. in 1972 in Burlington, New Jersey, and has had its headquarters in South Jersey for decades, but the company announced last week it's moving to Philadelphia.
Yo, Philly.
And the Business Journal is out today with a nice behind-the-scenes look at how the deal came together. Mm-hmm. Burlington's leaders said they wanted a space for 2,000 corporate employees. They wanted
yeah.
easy access to their other major office in New York City. So they essentially were looking up and down the train line on the East Coast and decided that there is a brand new vacant office building right by 30th Street Station.
Bam.
And that was the perfect fit. And this is a big deal, Cherry, for the city, because this is now the third Fortune 500 company
yeah.
that Philadelphia will have joining Comcast and Aramark. And it's just a big win in terms of like this post-pandemic conversation.
Yeah.
Will we still have downtowns with office towers where
I love it.
Workers congregate? And Burlington clearly is leaning into this idea. Some workers might not be thrilled, but the sweetener from the city is they're going to pay for all the SEPTA transportation for those workers for a year.
There you go. We got 2,000 jobs based in Philly. That's a boon to the wage tax. So welcome, Burlington people. Also, boon to local businesses along the Market Street corridor. And does this mean we get to call it, it's called Burlington. Will we call it Philly?
Philly
Philadelphia?
Yeah, Philadelphia. Probably
I don't know.
I think they'll stick with their branding.
Yeah, too soon. Let them move in first. We'll warm up to them. So we're going to be talking about the Academy of Natural Sciences. We'd love to hear your take. 888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Studio 2. Welcome back to Studio 2 here on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg. You've probably heard that the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University is slated to close at the end of this month. It's the country's oldest natural history museum. The news came out last week and hit the museum fans really, really hard. There have been petitions, social media blitzes, and rallies to pressure officials to reverse course. Drexel and the Academy blame the closure on declining attendance and rising operating costs, and they've said that they will preserve the renowned collections that include tens of millions of specimens and fossils, and they hope to eventually make them accessible to the public down the road. But this hasn't quelled public outcry over that decision. And so today, we're going to find out what led to this decision, the plans for the Academy's future, and if there's a possible path to keep the Academy open. And starting us off is Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Peter Dobrin, did I say that right? Dobrin, yep. Who has been covering this news. Peter, welcome to Studio 2. Thank you so much for being here in person.
Thanks for having me.
And by the way, listeners, we'd love to hear from you. What place has the Academy had in your life? What memories will you carry with you? And what do you hope happens next? The number to call is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And for our Facebook and YouTubers, hello. You can leave your comments and memories in the live chat. And so, Peter, this institution has been kept alive through wars, depressions, pandemics, and more than two centuries of change. And so I wanted to sort of level set and just have you explain to us why 2026 has been the moment where we can no longer keep the Academy of Natural Sciences open.
Hmm. Well, I mean, I think there are probably a couple of big pressures happening right now simultaneously. One, of course, is the financial problems that Drexel itself is having. Mm-hmm. They're trying to trim costs and balance their budget. They're facing some headwinds as far as enrollment trends that are affecting all colleges and universities across the country. The other factor is that, you know, we've had about four decades worth of growth in the arts and culture community here. We've built new buildings, we've established new organizations, and we've had this long period of growth. And as the arts and culture community has grown, funding has not grown with it. Mm. So when the pandemic struck, it left a lot of organizations vulnerable because audiences did not return in the same numbers that there were before the pandemic. So, you know, I want to set that issue of audience post-pandemic aside for a second to say that the Academy's attendance has been dropping for much longer than that. If mm-hmm. you look at their visitorship going back 10 or 12 years, it's kind of been floating down ever since then. It's
yeah.
bobbed up and down a little bit from year to year, but basically it's about half of where it was a dozen years ago or so.
And just to be clear, I mean, Drexel University is a partner of the Academy of Natural Sciences, and I just want people to really understand Drexel's role here because they don't own the museum, but they are a financial contributor. Like, how does that work? What is that relationship?
Well, they signed a partial merger agreement, I think is the best way to think about it, is in that in 2011, they announced this partnership and affiliation agreement, and So they share a lot of expenses and resources, but the Academy of Natural Sciences is a wholly owned subsidiary of Drexel University. Okay. But unlike other mergers, they came out of this agreement with two separate boards intact.
So, yeah. So they have some autonomy.
Exactly.
And so for folks who, Drexel came in 2011, but of course the Academy has been around for many, many years and generations before that. For people who may not understand the significance of the Academy of Natural Sciences, I want you to give a brief history lesson so that people understand just, you know, its founding and the scope of what it has brought to the scientific community.
Yeah. Well, it's been at the center of the international scientific conversation for almost its entire existence. You know, they sent out expeditions in the early days that made important discoveries. They've funded and conducted all kinds of research over the years. Ruth Patrick, who was a freshwater ecologist starting in the 1930s at the Academy of Natural Sciences, her work contributed to and became integral to the Clean Water Act of the 1970s. She advised presidents on all sorts of environmental issues. Academy scientists over the years have made very important discoveries. People like Ted Deschler, who's still there today and discovered a really important fossil that I'm sure I'm not putting this in the most scientific way, but basically it establishes a link between fish and creatures that came up onto land. I mean, they've really been at the forefront of a lot of research. And at the same time, as you noted, they've collected something like 19 million species.
Yeah.
Or specimens collections.
Yeah, and just before, because we have the deputy mayor on the line, we're going to bring her in just a moment. But I want to talk about the impact on the community, because a lot of kids, a lot of people were introduced as children to the Academy of Natural Sciences through field trips. Can you talk about the educational engagement that took place, you know, for young people, but also within the scientific community? You touched on that because a lot of people did their research here. People, other universities, they traveled here. I mean, this has been a real repository of education.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it. The education goes across the entire spectrum from people who went to the Academy for the first time when they were six or seven and then became scientists, and some of them worked at the Academy later, to people who just had a sort of, you know, passing interest as science kids. But it's an important place where you can do hands-on science. It's an important place where you can come face-to-face with a diorama that shows you a Kodiak bear or, you know, a rare species, something that's not around anymore.
So the impact is ripple effect. I want to ask you, as someone who covers this, were you shocked by this announcement at all?
Yeah, I was. I was surprised they closed the museum.
And I just wonder, because people were just floored. And part of it was because it feels like this came out of nowhere, that did you have any indication that the straits were as dire as Drexel and museum officials are making it before now? And any indication of why they didn't come to the public previously?
I don't actually think the situation is dire. I think that the Academy has been running a small but manageable deficit for a number of years. And while that's troublesome from a structural point of view, you don't want it to continue. Mm-hmm. There's nothing insurmountable about this. If you figure out that the Academy, say, needs $5 million to get it through the next fiscal year, to figure out what the plan is going to be on an ongoing basis, $5 million sounds like a lot of money to you and me. But when you think about the fact that Opera Philadelphia, which has a much smaller audience, is successfully raising over $30 million over 3 years, it seems to me there must be a way of saving this museum.
And we'll put a pin in that. And I think this is a perfect moment to talk about future plans for the Academy. And so I want to welcome Deputy Mayor Trish Wellenbach, who has been appointed Senior Advisor to the Academy of Natural Sciences during this transition. Deputy Mayor, welcome to Studio 2.
No, thank you for having you, Peter. Good to see you again.
Hi, Trish.
Yes. And by the way, I want to just repeat the questions of the day. You can email in our questions of the day. What place has the Academy had in your life and what memories will you carry with you? 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. Deputy Mayor, I just wanted to start and just level set with you by you sort of explaining to people what your role is, because you work for the city. You're not necessarily, mm-hmm. but you've been, I guess, appointed to this role. You're not being compensated by Drexel or the museum. What is your role and your job in this transition?
Yeah, so it's I am there for a short period of time. First of all, I want to reinforce the mayor's deep commitment to the history and the legacy of the Academy of Natural Sciences, her great respect for that institution. Mm-hmm. And also her respect for Drexel and Drexel's presence in our community. Two very, very highly regarded entities, not just in Philadelphia, but around the world. Mm-hmm. I was asked to do this to give some runway to a little bit of what Peter's talking about, to see if there might be an opportunity for us to take a step back and see how, when, and where we could continue to have the museum public-facing parts of the Academy sustained long-term.
Okay.
This moved a little quickly, I'll give you that much. Mm-hmm. And I'm here to serve the city at the mayor's request, and that's why I am, you know, delighted, honored, and humbled that she asked me to carry this on her behalf, so that we can be sure that we're deeply engaged in whatever the plan is going to be going forward.
And Deputy Mayor, I just want to be clear. Are you managing a closure, or are you saying that you've been empowered to explore alternatives to possibly keeping the museum open?
I would say both. As Mayor Parker says, this is not an either or, it's a bit of a both and. The difficult decision to close the museum public-facing aspects of the Academy is done, right? Now, it doesn't mean it can't be undone. But I think to Peter's comment, the finances were getting to be too much. And it's not just, respectfully, it's not just what does it cost us to run the museum, but the building has a lot of deferred maintenance in it. And we have to think carefully and strategically about how we use the building going forward, if we can use the building going forward. There are a lot of public-facing experiences that will continue even past October 1, and that's with respect to scientists and others who will have access to the rare books library, to the collections, et cetera. And that work will continue. So the building will stay open, just the museum public-facing elements will not be available to the public now.
And to be clear, that means parents with their children will not have access to the museum after September 30th. I want to specifically dig into what authority does the city actually have? Are you guys just conveners, facilitators? Will you provide funding support? Like, what exactly is the city's role in this?
Yeah, my role is as a convener and a facilitator. And as an individual who's deeply committed to institutions like this,
the city itself, is the city, a source of funding, or is your presence just the main thing that the city is able to offer at this point?
At the moment in time, understanding where we are right now, my talent and my time is what the mayor and the city is contributing to this process. If over the course of the next 4 to 6 months, we do a comprehensive analysis of what it's going to take writ large to keep the museum facing experience open long term, there may be a different conversation.
Yeah. I guess you're here. You mentioned money is an issue. Is it more, you mentioned the building is an issue. What are the other big issues or problems that need to be solved if there would be a reverse of course here? Or is it even possible at this point?
Well, Peter knows me long enough and well enough to know I believe everything is possible. We just have to put smart people at the table and see what we can figure out. It might not look and feel like it does today, mm-hmm. but let's exhaust every option. You know, I just want to say, I was in the Academy this morning meeting with the leadership team. Over 14,000 people came to the Academy of Natural Sciences between Friday and Sunday. Okay, we cannot ignore that.
Yeah.
That is the community writ large speaking. But when I asked the team candidly, how many people have been coming? They say 40 or 60, right? 40 or 60 is not sustainable. I think Peter and I would agree on that. We have to figure out a way to really demonstrate the value proposition of all of what you talked about, and a child and a family and a school experiencing the magic and yeah. what the Academy can bring to them to create the future explorers and scientists of the world.
And Deputy, Mayor, I have to ask you, I mean, do you have any indication? And I asked Peter this, do you have any indication from the leadership of the Academy and of at Drexel why they didn't bring this issue to the public before now?
Yeah, you know, I got to tell you, I wasn't at the table, and we could spend a lot of time talking about the why.
Yeah.
What a coulda, shoulda, but I like to look forward. This is the situation we're in right now. We're hearing that really the community locally and maybe further afar really would like us to figure out a way to maintain the museum yeah. experience. We have, to Peter's reference, I mean, we've got 19 million specimens we have to take care of. We've got research that is underway and in process. There's a lot of vibrancy as it relates to the purpose of scientific inquiry and research that is happening all the time in the museum.
Yeah.
In the people there. And we're going to keep that going. We need to keep that going.
And so people have had a lot of questions, and so I, from what you just said, the goal is to focus on the collections. The science will continue. What will happen to the building? What will happen to the employees? Has anything been mapped out yet?
Okay. Nothing has been mapped out with respect to the building. There's been a lot of speculation. We know that the deferred maintenance on the building is a very significant number, and we have to be prudent about that. With respect to the staff, and I just wish we would all take a moment, you know, there are 80 plus or minus staff currently on staff at the Academy. And a portion of them, somewhere between 25 and 30, by the end of October will no longer be employed. We have to give those people the grace and space to adjust to a new reality for themselves. And we also have to honor their work. And we also have to think about the people who are gonna continue to be actively employed by the Academy and continue this important work. And so part of my job is to support the human part. Yeah. The inside the building human part. And I get it about the kids. I'm a grandmother of six children, and I have two kids who go to bed every night wearing dinosaur head dolls. Yeah. So I'm good to go on that.
Yeah. And I got to ask you before I let you go. I mean, there has been this public outcry. What can the average Philadelphian do who feels some kind of way and they have a lot of energy? I mean, you've seen the rallies, hundreds of people showing up. What should they do right now? I mean, September 30th is just a couple of weeks away.
I would tell them to continue to show up at the museum because it is an affirmation of the importance of it. There was a great editorial in today's Inquirer saying, don't just show up, donate. Make your voices known. I mean, Peter knows this. We're a city that worked hand in glove to keep a painting here, a very important painting. Yeah. As important as the Academy of Natural Sciences in this museum. So what are we going to do as a community writ large? All of us together.
Yeah.
Great respect for the governor for bringing David Cohen in. Great respect for the mayor for asking me to serve. This is civic engagement, possibly the finest example of a public-private partnership in its beginning stages that we may have in this city. So let's leverage.
Yeah. I guess my last question for you, a year from now, if you look back, what will success mean to you as someone who's led in this space? Like what does success look like when you're talking about managing a closure of a beloved institution?
Success will be that we have honored the individuals who work in that building as they adjust to a new world order for themselves. Success will be that we have done the work to understand all the options and that we have charted a path to the future of an Academy of Natural Sciences that will be bright and vibrant and will have an opportunity to contribute to research, scientific inquiry, and the engagement of children and others in the importance of this part of learning about what the world is all about. That will be success. It won't be all done, but we will be on a path.
Thank you very much. That was Deputy Mayor Trish Wellenbach, who has been appointed Senior Advisor to the Academy of Natural Sciences during this closure transition. Deputy Mayor, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
And so, Peter, I wanted to bring it back to you. I mean, you heard, I wanted to give you a moment to react to what the deputy mayor had to say. What questions sort of bubbled up in your head as you hear her talking about closing this beloved institution and sort of balancing the human aspect of it?
Well, I think it's really important to do the work that Trish was talking about, to do a feasibility study for the institution to see what's possible, to get a real number on what deferred maintenance is, as opposed to moving to some other facility, because that's the other part of the equation, is we don't know, you know, it could be that $20 million is needed for this current building, but if moving means $50 million, you know, then we need to know that. We also need to do, you know, a fundraising study about what the capacity might be for supporters of the Academy. And we also, frankly, need to do some demographic studies. I mean, when Trish talks about 14,000 people having shown up at the Academy this past weekend, if that were true for every weekend of the year, there would be 750,000 people going through those doors, and you and I wouldn't be here having this conversation right now.
Yeah.
So what are the factors that led to that? Is it an overcrowded arts and culture environment where people have too many options? Is it the fact that kids today are busy doing chess and soccer and ballet and other things that, you know, used to be an hour a week, but now are taking very serious amounts of time, you know, out of their schedules? I mean, what is the environment for this museum?
Yeah. Thank you so much, Peter. And by the way, we're opening up the phone lines on the other side of this break. Slow Food emails their favorite memory saying eating bugs during Bug Fest. We're going to open up the phone lines. We'd love to hear from you. What place has the Academy had in your life? What memories will you carry with you? 888-477-9499. And I got to say thank you to Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Peter Dobrin for being on Studio 2. We look forward to hearing your voice. This is Studio 2. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Studio 2 on WHYY. I'm Cherry Gregg. This hour, we've been talking about the announced closure of the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University, the nearly 200-year-old museum on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway, and efforts to keep it open. And now we have two scientists joining us to help us understand what the museum has done, what closure means for researchers and for the public. We have Allison Tumarkin Terzian, Temple University professor and paleontologist. Welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you.
And we also have Issa Betancourt, an entomologist who previously worked at the Academy. Issa, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
And of course, listeners, we'd love to hear from you. What place has the Academy had in your life? What memories will you carry with you? And what do you hope happens next? You can give us a call, 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're on YouTube or Facebook, you can leave your comments in the live chat. I want to read a couple comments because Sebastian says, I have a one-year-old and we have a family membership to the Natural History Museum and have already taken them multiple times. I grew up in Philadelphia going to the museum, sleepovers for Halloween, and I was so excited to see my son choosing to sleep under his favorite exhibit, and it hurt to hear that won't be a part of his childhood. And so I wanted to sort of start the conversation by your personal experiences a little bit, because Issa, you spent nearly a decade working at the Academy. You since moved to Arizona, and you decided to come back to Philadelphia to take part in the rally to save the Academy. Tell us briefly a little bit of your experience and why it was so important for you to fly all the way back across the country to be here in this moment.
Yeah, just like anyone else in the Philadelphia area, the Academy, going there as a kid for school field trips is like a baptism or rite of passage in the area. It's something that nearly everyone here has done. So I did that as a kid and then got connected later on in life through my senior project mandated by the Pennsylvania State. And then later I worked there for many years and saw so many transformations from scientists. Their first times educating the public was there in the public space, and just so many kids being inspired and having this amazing community space is so important.
That's so beautiful. And Allison, before you were bringing Temple students there, you were a graduate student, you working around the Academy, even participating in an expedition connected to a big time discovery. Tell us a little bit about your personal connection to the Academy of Natural Sciences.
Yes, so I did not grow up in Philadelphia. I grew up in New York, experience at the American Museum of Natural History, but I started at grad school at the University of Pennsylvania in 1997. And through the graduate program there in paleontology, I also had experience at the Academy working in the collections there, being a volunteer preparator in the prep lab. And through that, there was a joint expedition between Penn and the Academy in 1999 and 2000 out to Montana. And we discovered Siuwassia.
And tell us what that
Siuwassia
is.
Siuwassia is a sauropod dinosaur, long-necked, long-tailed, related to Apatosaurus and Diplodocus, those more famous ones. It was a new genus known to science. We discovered it there. I worked on the excavation. I worked on preparing some of the material in the prep lab at the Academy, public facing. So we were teaching families about the new dinosaur that we had found while they were visiting and we were prepping the bones out.
I have to say, pause. That's exciting.
It was amazing.
A brand new discovery as a young scientist. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's burned into your nervous system forever.
Yes. And the bones are held at the Academy. The holotype specimen that we found is in the Academy collections. Some of it is on display in the gallery.
Yeah. And I have to say,
it warms my heart.
I know. And I just have to say that you both got a little giddy telling your stories and your personal connections to the Academy. And I have some people on the line. Let me bring a couple folks in because I know they have that same giddy feeling. And again, our questions of today, what place has the Academy had in your life and what memories will you carry with you? Our number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. Peggy says, I volunteered at the Academy in 1971 and 72, working with live animals and preschoolers and small groups on what my family called the Dead Zoo. It was magical. I'll always remember Iris, the porcupine, and the great horned owl that I handled. Look at that wonder there. Let's bring Greg from Philadelphia, who's on the line. Greg, you're on Studio 2. Briefly, share your memory of the Academy.
Sure. Well, I was a preparator there in the aughts, and this has always been a problem. It was... the problem is that the Academy, the target audience or the audience that comes are 1 to 11-year-olds. Mm. And after that, less and less and less, you know, we're trying to do lots of programs for adults and things like that. Sadly, it's first and foremost an Academy. Like if people saw backstage what was happening, just drawers full of stuff. They have the largest collection or the only collection of this prehistoric algae floating there. Yeah, so it was first and foremost an Academy, a place to study.
Thank you.
That's all I want to say. Yeah. And I'm heartbroken as everybody, but not surprised at all.
Yeah, well, thank you. That's Greg from Philadelphia. Let's bring in one more caller for this segment, and we'll bring in some others in just a moment. We have Sabelle from Abington on the line. Sabelle, you're on Studio 2. What's your memory?
Oh, my goodness. I'm getting I'm opposite of giddy. I'm emotional right now thinking about it. My son and I, who's now 34, when he was 4, we spent the night at the museum. It was during Halloween, and it was a sleep out, and everybody came in their costumes, and we slept under the dinosaurs. And, of course, growing up in Abington, we all went to the Academy for field trips, as other yeah. people have said, and the animals and the, you know, the theater that is, you know, set yeah. up like, and it graduated, and they would have the birds fly around and the snakes and everything. I mean, it's just a core memory, and it's just really sad. I hope somebody knows a billionaire who can just throw a check at this and take care of it for a good long time.
Thank you. And that's Sibel from Abington, who shared her memories, and Karen from Wayne. We'll get to you in just a moment. But I wanted you both, Issa, just react to this and just talk about the accessibility point, because you both are scientists. You'll still have access to the Academy in October, but the kids won't. And so talk about this a little bit, Issa, as being an entry point to science for a lot of young people.
Yeah. So during my time at the Academy, I started a project where I was sampling insects from right across the street in Swan Fountain mm-hmm. to show people the amazing diversity right in our city. And during Bug Fest, I would show them, and some kids would be like, "What? You found that like over there?" And I was like, "Yeah, there's so much to discover right here." And then I've had other people come up. I'm talking to them for 5 minutes about insects, and then they say, "Wait, these are all real?" So it's so important to have this access point for the community, between the scientists and the community, to connect. And especially in this age of AI and truth decay, we need that connection, that community center, as much as possible.
Yeah. And what do you think it is? We had one of the callers who used to work there in the early 2000s, and he talked about this being primarily for children. And so I just want you to kind of react to what the callers had to say, and just this teaching tool kind of going away.
So I think I don't want to take away from the fact that it is a huge entry point for young people in science, but I don't want to ignore the adults.
Okay.
Because I think, you know, living in an urban environment, this is a way for everyone, not just the kids, to access the natural world and learn about the natural world. When I was a graduate student in the 90s and early 2000s, a lot of the volunteer docents were seniors, and they were having sort of a second career looking at their passion with working with the natural mm-hmm. world. And then the families and children would come and see someone who looked like grandma teaching them mm-hmm. about the natural world, the fossils, the insects, the live animals. It's the entire community that is going to be missing out on the access to this. And I think of myself growing up in New York, I had access to it. And I feel like we're telling the people of Philadelphia that, yeah, okay, New York has a museum and has access to this, and DC has a museum and has access to this, and you don't get to have access to this now without traveling somewhere else. This is a place that is accessible, easily accessible by public transportation, that everyone can go and contact the natural world.
And Allison, I want, and Issa, I want you to expand on what you said, because I'd love for you to react, Allison, to Issa's point about technology. I mean, people are watching AI videos and they think, oh, this is what bugs look like. They're looking at that. They're bringing dinosaurs back to life on YouTube, right? And can you just try to explain to us why it's so important to have a real life experience, and what the Academy did? Because kids were able to touch things. It was very hands-on.
You can see a lot online now that is real. And so there is more access for people to see things than in the past before that existed. But there is also a lot online that is not real. Like, you called it truth decay, and I love that term.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's no real way to tell if you haven't already encountered the real objects. Mm-hmm. And so there is definitely still, I would argue even more now, a place for contacting the real and understanding what's real about the natural world.
Yeah, and Issa, I'd love for you to expand on that. And how much of this is the responsibility of institutions to sort of promote that and sort of make themselves stand out as we have technology growing and encroaching in every part of our lives?
Yeah, well, I would say that, like, it's a huge feature to be able to just walk right in the door and connect with the scientists and see the real artifacts. And there are other institutions, like in North Carolina, where there is sustained public funding for these institutions. And the Academy has not received sustained public funding for the operations. We get the Academy gets funding in the forms of grants here and there, but there's not a sustained support from the public for all the good and outreach and all that it serves.
And there have been arguments that it's not the fault of the public here, that the Academy, given its 200-year-old history, should have had more public support. Do you both agree with that argument?
I'd say that the visitation is a result of other factors that are going on, where there needs to be more invested in resources for the institution itself to update exhibits and to unlock the stories of the Academy and of the specimens and to reach the modern day audience where it's at.
Yeah. And by the way, I want to bring in a couple more callers because people are sort of writing in. Maria on YouTube says the Academy of Natural Sciences is so much a part of the history of our nation. It is as important as the Liberty Bell and the Statue of Liberty. Our question of the day is, what place has the Academy had in your life and what memories will you carry with you? 888-477-9499. The email studio2@whyy.org. I'm going to bring in a couple callers back to back. We have Jerry calling in from Oregon. Jerry, you're on Studio 2. What's your memory?
Hi. I have an amazing story about the Academy. I am a child of the Academy, as though I sprang my whole body from the bricks and mortar of the building. Let me make this as quick as I can. My parents took me to the museum when I was 9 years old, and I grew up in Northeast Philly. This is in 1957, we're talking about, 57. I was a student at the Academy when I was 9 and 10 years old. When I was 11 and 12, I was noticed by one of the scientists and made a volunteer curatorial assistant. And I worked at the museum. Then I went to Temple University for a few years later and worked part-time at the Academy. And then I became head of the live animal department at the museum and was in that position from 1970 to 76. I did animal programs in the Academy each day pretty much, and then was on television on KYW, Channel 3, bringing live animals and showing them to the kids with the studio audience there. I went on to get my own PhD.
And Jerry, I have to cut you off because we only have 3 minutes left in the show and I got to bring another caller in. But Jerry's story goes from the very beginning. And Issa, you wanted to react.
Yeah, I wanted to say so many people have found their life partners at this museum, too. It's a place that people come together and are formed and shaped and their lives are changed.
Yeah, and Jerry's life definitely changed. He went into this field because of his experiences as a kid. Let's bring in Karen from Wayne, who's on the line. Karen, you're on Studio 2. If you could keep it really brief, like 20 seconds, please share your memory.
Favorite memories were the live butterfly exhibit with butterflies from all over the world. You entered the room and you were surrounded by them in all colors and shapes. And also the gem and mineral collection, which was extensive and had a great fluorescent mineral exhibit. It's the foundation of our city is EDS and MEDS.
Yeah.
And everything that is foundational to medicine was in that museum.
Yeah.
And it would be a stain on the city to ever let it close.
Thank you. That's Karen from Wayne. And so I just want you both to sort of talk about this closure and help us through the grieving and mourning process. Because people have a hope that there can be a turnaround. But we heard from the deputy mayor, it's very unlikely. Although people should keep trying because you never know. Help us through that. Like, what are you grieving? What sort of, you came all the way here, Issa, from Arizona. Allison, this was a place that literally changed the course of your career. Talk about what this process feels like for you guys. Yeah, go Issa.
Yeah, so I definitely was in shock at first and then definitely had my mourning and grieving moments, but then was like, we need to take action. We need to gather together, Philadelphia. I encourage everyone listening to visit save save-the-academy.org for ways to help and group, and so we can make a concerted effort to turn this around. And whatever that looks like, we need to save the public side of the museum.
Yeah. And your thoughts, Allison?
Very similar. For the past week or so since the announcement, there's been a lot of feeling like you've been punched in the gut. Yeah. You know, it's there's grieving, but there's I'm not willing to give up yet. I think there's a lot of work to be done, but I keep hoping that efforts can be made to save some of this. It may not look like what it looks like now, and that may be okay, but a public-facing aspect of this that gives access to the public to touch the natural world needs to remain.
And we heard from the deputy mayor who said this civic engagement matters. Don't let up. There's still time, right? Thank you to everybody who called in. And by the way, thank you to Allison, to Markin Dharatzian, Temple University professor and paleontologist. I appreciate you being here today, Allison. And also thank you to Issa Betancourt, an entomologist who previously worked at the Academy. And both of you are on the front lines fighting to keep it open. Thank you so much, Issa, for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you to everybody who shared their moments. You can keep those coming via email, studio2@whyy.org. And thanks to all the callers we couldn't get to. I understand there was a lot. So thank you for calling in. And thank you to our producers, Debbie Builder, Hazel May Bryan, and Ben Abrams. Mike Schiffler is our visual engineer. Al Banks engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCrory. I'm Cherry Gregg. I'll see you tomorrow.